Sort of the 12th man promoted up the order to do the batting now. If I speak, is it necessary?
And they were published in 1866, but they went unnoticed. At that time, the world was busy discussing about Darwin's monumental work, The Origin of Species. So the world came to know about the laws of heredity exactly at the beginning of the 20th century. So what did Mendel have to say? So the heredity information for every trait is sort of in a modular form. That what we call as genes today. And I couldn't resist this because 1900 was also the proposal of the quantum theory by Planck. So can we call the gene as a quantum of hereditary information? And in a diploid organism that reproduces sexually, there is one representation from each parent so that you have two of such factors in every diploid organism. And the field at this point was called classical genetics because Mendel or his immediate followers did not worry about what the gene is, what is it made of, how it functions. All that mattered was its impact on the organism. And what the beautiful thing about classical genetics is a lot could be derived from just observing transmission. What would happen if you set up a particular cross which had property. So, and primarily, heredity was controlled by two laws, the law of segregation and the law of independent assorts. What these mean, we'll just highlight in a short moment. So, how does one know that there is a gene in the first place? So you have to first look at a trait. So the trait has an external manifestation, and that external manifestation is what was called the phenotype. So the phenotype comes first, and then you extrapolate that to a genotype. So how does that work? In the case of the plant, you have a tall plant and you have a short plant. So the trait is the height of the plant, and the external manifestation is the form, either tall form or the short form. So if you have an individual who is tall, then the assumption is that there are two genes, one derived from each parent, represented as capital T and capital T. And if it's a short plant, two factors represented as small t, and small t, because there are two parents and the factors come together. So on the left side is what's the genotype. The phenotype, and on the right-hand side, it's what's called the genotype. So now you have a peculiar situation. what happens when you cross a tall plant to a short plant. So you have a sort of hybrid generation. That's what Mendel called. So in the case of the hybrid generation, they still exhibited, in the case of the plant, the tall phenotype. And based on this, it was predicted that the tallness is dominant over the shortness. And this term dominance and recessivity came. The shortness which disappeared in the hybrid generation is called recessive. So now what happened when you allow them to cross among themselves? That is what famously gives rise to the 3:1 ratio. And how does this work?
New pen.
I'm sorry, I didn't check it. It doesn't matter. So what happens? So if you have the hybrid generation of the genotype TP, the law of segregation simply says that when the gametes are formed, the T and T segregate for the equal follow. This is essentially the law of segregation. So if that happens, then you have gametes corresponding to T and T, and you can combine them, and the patterns that you get are very so these are all taught. This is short. You have the 3:1 ratio. And what about independent assortment? So here you are looking at the segregation of two. These are called, by the way, these are called alleles. The capital T form and the small T form are alleles of each other. So in the case of independent assortment, what that means is that when you look at two traits being inherited simultaneously, say like the height of the plant and the color of the seed, the factors or the genes corresponding to each trait is inherited independent of each other. That gives you the 9:3:1 ratio. So now what transpired from all these studies? Mendel's laws were actively pursued by Morgan, who was sort of the flag bearer of classical genetics. And much of the laws were proven to be true, but there were also, of course, exceptions. And the main thing that came out of classical, one of the main concepts that came out of classical genetics is the fact that phenotypes is invariably correlated with genotype. So anytime you have a new phenotype, you can always associate that with a mutation. And this is highlighted by the discovery of white rhizopus and the fruit fly. So just pick it up, and then immediately you say that there is a mutation, and that's why the normal red eye of the fly is transformed into a white eye phenotype. And this concept that genotype always determines phenotypes came to be known as genetic determinism. Today, many people still believe that this is true, 100%. But that's what Patrick and many others who spoke before me tried to debunk, saying that the relationship between genotype and phenotype is much more complex, and there are many other interactions. So what I would like to do is take you through some of the more recent findings. Okay. So even in the early days of classical genetics, it was clear that the genotype-phenotype relation was not that straightforward. And it happened in the case of a particular mutation called the lobe mutation. And the lobe mutation, what it does is it reduces the number of eye facets in the Drosophila. So as you know, the insects, they have compound eyes. So there are many omatidia. And in the case of the lobe mutation, even in the heterozygous situation, since it's a dominant mutation, you have reduction in the number of eye facets. But what was rather unusual was if you look at individuals who apparently have the same genotype, they have, it's known by crosses, but they know that the geneticist knows that the lobe mutation is there, and so there has to be the phenotype manifestation. That's the expectation. But when you look at it, that's not the case. So there are variations. In some cases, the phenotype is apparent, in some cases it's not apparent. So even in those cases where the phenotype is apparent, there is a gradation in terms of the number of microfilters completed. In this case, there's complete absence of any homotidia, but also the mutants, the so-called mutants, also have normal eyes, and many things in between them. So this was a puzzle. So what? This is a straightforward genetic cross. You still remember, this is the era of classical genetics. We have not tried to worry about what the gene is, how is it functioning, what the molecular basis. So, but then geneticists are very quick. inventing a new jargon, so that can explain many things. So the jargon that was invented, something called penetrance. So the geneticists say every mutation is not 100% penetrant. So penetrance is the percentage whereby you look at the offspring of the genotype, in how many cases that phenotype is manifested, that is penetrance. So in the case of the low mutation, 75%, because in 25% cases there is no phenotype at all. The eyes appear to be normal. Okay. And then there is another expression, because you see this variation. This variation can also be quantified, and this variation within the same genotype is also called expressivity. So now the question is, what is the reason for this variation? Why is the penetrance for different mutations different? Why is the expressivity for different mutations also different? So there are many possibilities. One is the environment. Other loci within the genome, they also can contribute. See, if you look at the classical Mendelian concept, one trait means one locus. So you cannot have, so that trait is influenced only by that locus. So it's believed that no other loci in the genome influences the phenotype at that particular locus. So clearly, that cannot be the case. So there has to be much more complex interaction between the locus under consideration as well as other loci in the genome. So now, other loci in the genome, fluctuations in particular components in the cell, that's what we now call stochastic or bent edging of the cell, dynamic nature of the mutation. So in many cases, the mutations are not a single entity, but it's a very dynamic entity. I'll explain what this means in a moment. So one person who did a fair amount of work on the gene-environment interaction was Lancelot Hoffman, the British geneticist, not that popularly known, but he was the one who championed the cause of phenotype being influenced by environment. Okay, so in 1933, he published a nice paper in the Journal of Genetics, currently published by the Indian Academy of Sciences. Very interesting observation. So what he did was, this was another mutation in Drosophila called the BRI. So here also, very similar to in the case of low mutation, the number of homotidia is less. But here, the way they are formed is also different. So they form something like a bar-like structure. The homotidia line up and form that slit-like eyes as far as the slice and so on. And there are two allelic variations of this. One is called intra-bar. So the phenotype is not very strong, but you can still pink up. And there's another allele called the ultra-bar, which is much more severe. It's a hypermorph. The other one, what geneticists call a hypomorph. Okay. So what he did was try to quantify the number of homotidia and severity of the phenotype expressed as a function of temperature. So temperature is probably one of the most easily alterable external environments. So when the flies were grown under different temperatures, so what's interesting is that he used the wild-type, intra-bar, and ultra-bar, and showed that the number of homotidia vary, but the pattern of variation has no logical kind of explanation.
in this case, y type, the number of moments here decrease with temperature, with decreasing temperature,
but at a certain grade.
But if you take the infrared, in fact, the effect is exactly opposite. It actually increases over a light range with temperature. And in the case of ultraviolet, it is similar to the white light, but the slope is much steeper. So these then correlation of phenotypic variation with environment, he called the term norm of reaction. Vidya mentioned this in his lecture also. So the relation between the phenotype and environment conditions, the take-home message from this experiment was the interaction between the genotype and the environment is very complex. You cannot make a general sweeping statement as to how genotype will respond to changes in the environment. For different alleles of the same locus itself, you can see very dramatic differences in terms of the way they behave. So now, if you look at the present day context, there are several heritable diseases. So the question of penetrance and expressivity becomes very important in terms of diagnosis as well as prognosis of those individuals. So, and the question is, why does penetrance vary for different disorders? And this has been well documented in the case of many diseases which are due to what's called trinucleotide repeats. So if you have the affected locus, what happens is the mutation that happens is not single, not a deletion or an insertion of a nucleotide or a missense mutation, but there's a stretch of trinucleotides that is present in the wild type allele also, the normal allele also. And by a process of amplification, this can become larger. The length of the trinucleotide will become larger and smaller. So that way, this is what I call as dynamic mutation in the previous case. So many human genetic disorders have this kind of mutational pattern. So you have a very severe polymorphism in the case of such mutations. So you have completely normal individuals who have the repeat lengths are very small, and then there is something what's called a pre-mutation situation where you have intermediate level of increase in terms of the trinucleotide repeat, and then the full-blown mutation condition in which it has happened, so that the mutation has changed quite a bit. So the length has increased quite a bit. And in fact, the variation can also be brought about in a differential manner. For example, in the case of the disorder called fragile X, it's an X-linked mutation. And individuals who actually show this trait have several sort of deformities. One of them is mental retardation. And you can, the reason why it is called fragile X, at the karyotype stage itself, you can see that the X chromosome, one locus on the X chromosome looks a little bit fragile, as if it's hanging out and it's about to snap at any point. And this is caused by the increase in the repeat length. Okay. So, and what's rather interesting about this is that the X chromosome that you inherit through the mother and the X chromosome that you inherit from the father behave in a different fashion. So in the case of the father to daughter transmission, there is no increase in the repeat length. But many cases, the increase in the repeat length happens during meiosis in the mother, so that during oogenesis, there is the alteration in the repeat length, which is not seen in the case of spermatogens. This has been documented in the case of fragile X syndrome. So again, showing that sex-dependent alteration in terms of the dynamic nature of the mutation. So now come to another interesting aspect. This was touched upon by Patrick, and in fact, this was raised during one of the discussion questions also. So now if you look at the so-called wild-type stocks of flies, or any other organism for that matter, if you look at any of the important traits such as musculature, wing shape, wing structure, eyes, all those factors that are necessary for survival, there is not much variation that you can see from individual to individual. So the earlier idea was that such traits have been maintained without much of genetic variation due to what Darwin called purifying selection. So if any mutation occurs in any of those genes, the flies will not survive, therefore those are eliminated. Okay, so the purifying selection maintains genetic variation at these important loci to the minimum. This was the idea. But this was kind of thrown out by a pretty elegant experiment, a series of experiments that was done by developmental biologist Boddington. Patrick introduced his experiments. He was one who coined the term epigenetics for the first time. What he could show is that the robustness that you see in terms of many traits, it's actually misleading. There is a substantial amount of genetic variation among individuals, but this genetic variation is not manifested phenotypically because of a buffering process, which is called for analyzing. So what exactly is this buffering process? The buffering is brought about, so if there is a variation in one of those loci, that variation is neutralized by a modifier mutation at another locus. So the mutation and the modifier locus, when they coexist, the phenotype is wild type. So there are so many such mutations have occurred, but those mutations have been nullified by the presence of modifying mutation at other loci. And this process of mutations happening and modifiers trying to modify them and neutralize them, that process is called genetic assimilation. And genetic assimilation leads to the property what is called canalization, which means that externally, even though the organisms have very high degree of genetic variability, they do not express this. And all the traits that are essential for survival are maintained in a buffered condition known as canalization. So now what happens? So how do we see that there is genetic variation? What he did was, you just simply subject the flies to stress. And then once stress is applied, this buffering can be sort of relieved. So you can actually expose the genetic variation. That's exactly what he did. And the stress that he introduced was, again, just like Hogben, temperature. So when the developmental stages, and the temperature was raised, what was a heat shock, it can accept it in a process. And when this happened, so he could actually get a very wide variety of phenotypes. Okay. Simply by raising the temperature during the developmental stages of the fly. So, for example, one of the mutations that you could see is called cross-veinedness. Okay, so this is, unfortunately, I don't have a picture of the fly, but the cross-veinedness simply means that if you look at the wing, these are the venation patterns. There are cross-connectivity, just like a leaf, the fly wing, very beautiful, tiny structure. And in the case of the cross-veinedness mutation, these cross-connections between the veins are missing. But geneticists have already shown that there is a X-linked mutation called cross-veinedness. So single locus mutation, if you have, you'll get the cross-veinedness phenotype. But in this case, the same phenotype is obtained simply by subjecting the flies to elevated temperature. Okay? So what is interesting is that the effect, the phenotypic effect seen is transient. So now if you take those cross-veinedness flies and then breed them at normal temperature, then they will go back to the wild type again. So that means that the phenotype what you see in technical parlance, genetics parlance, is called phenocopy. So you have a phenotype manifesting without a genetic change. And the reason why this happens is because whatever the gene product is supposed to do, its effect has been prevented not by a mutation, but some kind of physical alteration. So in such instances, they are called phenocopies. So here also, the cross-veinedness phenotype that you see is a phenocopy.
But what he did was, he kept on persisting with this experiment. So now you take the cross-linked this fly, and then cross them. So you take males and females and you cross them. Okay? And then again subject the progeny to heat shock. So a certain proportion of the progeny will have again cross-linked this phenotype. Pick up those, again cross them, and again subject them to heat shock. Okay, so this cyclic process of selection, so this is a case of an artificial selection, okay, homing on one particular phenotype. There are a plethora of phenotypes being produced, but he was focusing on selected number of phenotypes. Okay. So then, after about 13 generations, when you cross the males and the females having the phenotype, now you can get heritable cross-linkedness phenotype without the heat shock. Okay, so earlier it was a phenotype. So now, after 12 to 13 rounds of heat shocking selection and then continuing the cycle for 13 generations, you have now made this change into a heritable phenotype. And what exactly has happened? So what is happening here is that there is canalization. So the cross-veinless, the mutations responsible for giving the cross-veinless phenotype is already there in the wild type. Okay, but that is not seen because of the presence of other mutations, other modifying mutations, what had accumulated as a process of genetic assimilation. And since you have the mutations and the modifiers simultaneously being present, you have wild type phenotype. But now when you heat shock, you're breaking open the canalization process and exposing the genetic variation. And by keeping the selection on the cross-veinless phenotype again and again over 13 generations, what you're doing is you're crossing away the modifier loci from the mutation loci. So that now there's no more, after 13 generations, there's no modifier present, you only have the mutations present, and therefore you get a phenotype.
So it will be same in the plant system also?
Sorry?
This process will be same in the plant system also?
With which system?
Plant
system. So the plant experiments were done, I'll come to that in a minute. Waddington didn't do any plant experiment, but somebody else did. And they could show that similar things can happen in the plant system. Okay. So successive cycles of heat shock selection, the subject, even the absence of the tree. So this heat stress selection had actually exposed the genetic variation. And the cross-linkless phenotype, which is similar to the sex B mutation, can now be given by combination of different mutations. Yes?
I'm confused by this experiment. If you didn't give them heat shock, kept crossing them for 13 generations, and at each generation selected those guys who had this mutation expressed, you would eventually be selecting those flies who did not have the compensating mutations, and then
so
establish.
The problem is, if you don't do the heat shock, they will all give you wild type phenotype.
So it just the heat shock just enabled you to see those guys,
yes,
who
exactly,
had it.
Exactly. Okay. So that's the process of what he calls canalization. Because of canalization, you will not see the phenotype, even though the mutations are present. So this simply exposes the diversity. So when
did he conduct a control experiment also without the heat shock?
The experiment what he designed was really fantastic. I didn't want to go into the detail. I've given sort of a resonance article written by Vijayan in the reading material. So, in fact, he did an experiment, what is now known as SIP selection, in which you can actually do this experiment without subjecting the flies to any heat shock. What you do is you take those flies, you show the phenotype, subject half of them to heat shock, and just cross the other without the heat shock. Means that stock which Paul Deeping showed them have already got that mutation. So even without subjecting over a period of SIP selection, what Deeping could show that. So the heat shock was not necessary. Okay. So as long as you know that you are enriching for those mutations in a particular sub line of manifestation process, they have been suppressed. So they give you the wild-type phenotype, and the mutant phenotype is not manifest. And what is the significance of this? One of the significances is that you can have, under particular environment, robust phenotype, but at the same time have ready-made mutations, okay, which will give you a phenotype under appropriate conditions. So now you change the environment, already the variability is there, built into the system, and now when the environment changes, the environment can pick and select whichever trait that is adaptive, and then evolution can proceed in this way. So when, if environment changes very rapidly, you don't have to wait for genetic variability to arise. Already the genetic variability is there, ready made, and the system is ready to go. And natural selection can then home in on the appropriate trait that is adaptive.
Mahi?
Yeah.
If you don't mind, could you explain that canalization as well?
Yeah. So, it is. Canalization literally means channeling. So what happens here?
Coming to the variance?
Yes. So the idea is that all the flies, wild type flies, look alike. They look very robust. There is no genetic variability, no phenotypic variability. But there is built-in differences in terms of their genotype that is not apparent. So what canalization has done is by selecting for modifier mutations, the genetic variability is suppressed so that all you see is wild type phenotype. But now the environment changes, that buffering is released so that now you are able to bring out the hidden genetic variability and as a result express a wide variety of phenotype.
Do you have the slide in which it shows the canalization figure?
It's there in Vidya's article.
You know, to make clear to the audience.
Right.
Well,
so that really, I think the CD, I think it was, the article is there. Vidya's article has a pictorial representation of the canalization process.
And in the degree of canalization of any
kind. So as far as, I mean, if it's a trait that is essential for survival, you need as close to wild type phenotype as possible.
Sure.
Yes.
I was just going to ask whether you could bring this up to date with recent findings in terms of concepts of modifiers, what they
yes,
are.
Yes, that's what I'm going to
say. Is there anything you don't walk away?
Very recently,
1998, an experiment was made with my or some people like me.
Yes.
Seems to be okay. Okay, better. So what Susan Lindquist and Rutherford did in 1998, this is a paper published in Nature. In this case, they tried something very similar to what Waddington did. But instead of heat shocking the flies, they used a mutant of one of the genes coding for a heat shock protein, HSP19. And this is one of those molecular chaperones. So they took a mutant strain of this. So as a result, the HSP90 function is compromised in this. Okay. When they did this experiment, so it's similar to heating or subjecting the fly to the heat shock. So what happens in the heat shock? You have expression of the heat shock proteins, but many times because there are large number of misfolded proteins, the heat shock proteins are overloaded. So they can't handle enough of the chaperoning function. And therefore, the phenotype is similar to using a mutant where you have actually subject the fly to a heat shock.
What's
the chaperone? Chaperone, okay, I'm sorry, this is another jargon. So this is a molecule that helps other proteins to fold in the proper configuration. Helps in the folding. So they act as a scaffold and assist these proteins to fold in the proper fashion. Okay. So particularly HSP90 has been shown to be involved in
in the folding of many critical regulatory proteins, proteins that are involved in gene regulation during development. So now if you are compromised for HSV19, if the regulatory protein is not 100% wild type, if there are mutations, normally what happens is if there is a mutation in these genes, the chaperone will sort of smooth over the conformational deformity, so that in the presence of HSV, functional HSV19, even though there is a mutation in those regulators, that can be masked. So that masking is done by adding, latching on to the mutant protein and helping them to fold even though they are mutant. So, but once the HSV90 function is compromised, then those regulators cannot fold, and therefore they cannot mediate proper regulation, and therefore you get a phenotype. And here also, incidentally, it's a phenocopy. So now, if you take those flies which show the mutant phenotype and bring in wild-type HSV90, the mutation goes away. Okay, very similar to the heat shock experiment that Waddington did.
What was the reason for suppression of that gene?
Which
gene?
The gene which was not being expressed. It's an allele, HSV90 allele. That's a well documented mutation in the chaperone gene. Okay. So this is from the Rutherford Lindquist paper to show the plethora of enormous amount of. So this is, for example, this one looks like the Notch mutation. But this is all a phenocopy. So if we now bring back wild type HSV90, this phenotype disappears. You have even white eye. This is a white eye mutation brought about by the heat shock, by the HSV90 mutation. So several, so this is a CGL beam type of mutation. This is just to show that a single locus impairment, mutation of HSV90, gives you a wide variety of phenotypes. But the interesting thing is they are all phenocopies. So now what they did in 2001, they followed up this work with a work on SLAM, Arabidopsis. That was published in the, I think it's in the journal Cell. This is 2001. The problem is they can't use a mutant because Arabidopsis has 5 copies of the HSV90 gene. So they use a chemical inhibitor of this gene product and showed the same kind of phenomenon. What was very surprising is that in the case of the plant, the phenotypes produced resemble the differences in the phenotype that you see with altitude and with temperature. Have plants at various altitudes and various temperatures, you have the same genotype gives you different phenotypes. So similar traits could be shown up in the case of the plant system when they use an inhibitor of HSV90. Based on that, they predicted that this ready-made genetic variability gives you an immediate impetus to evolve when the environment changes very drastically. Yes, sir. Of hammering to get rid of this erroneous idea, that facts accumulated give you the example from the bacterial system. Unlike what it was believed earlier, bacteria also have genes which are functionally similar, whose products are functionally similar to histones. So one of them is called HNS. So HNS stands for histone-like substring protein. Histone-like structuring protein, what it does is it binds to DNA in a rather non-specific manner. It doesn't have any sequence specificity, just like the way histones do, but it has some preference for DNA that is rich in AT sequences. And when it binds, it also turns off a large number of genes. Just like the way the formation of the chromatin shuts off gene expression in the eukaryotes, binding of this HNS protein also shuts off several genes. So now it is known that it's not only HNS, but there's a family of proteins, HU, IH, IFS, there are so many different members belonging to this family who collectively keep the bacterial genome in a silent state. But the binding of HNS and other family of proteins, they don't resemble exactly the histones, because in the case of the chromatin in higher organisms, it has much higher order structure. So there's a nucleosome kind of structure, then there's packing, and then compacting. So that kind of compaction is not there in the bacterial chromosome, but nonetheless, having these proteins brings about enormous flexibility in terms of gene expression. In fact, it's believed, there's a fair amount of evidence, that the HNS protein and its family of proteins evolve to silence horizontally transfer genes from other organisms. So that's supposed to be the role, but it has come out to be a major player in terms of regulating gene expression in bacteria. So the reason why I got HNS is that if you have an HNS mutation, it has pleiotropic properties. It changes the traits of many systems. One of them is in the genes encoding the capsular polysaccharides. They are overproduced so that if you streak an HNS mutant, the allele is very severe. The colony will be dripping down the plate because it will be finding new point as a result of the overproduction of polysaccharides. And the reason why we are interested in HNS is because it's a negative regulator of the genetic systems that we work with in the lab. So we are not subject them to antibiotic selection, again the same proportion of the order of less than 1% or so of cells which will still outlive the exposure to the antibiotic. So this is resistance without having any genetic alteration. Okay? And so the issue as to how this happens was rather puzzling. A lot of work has gone into understanding the phenomena of persistence. This was actually discovered long time ago, immediately after penicillin was discovered in the 40s. Vigar, he was a clinical microbiologist, British microbiologist, who showed that if you take bacteria and subject them to penicillin treatment, you have survivors. He was the one who coined the term persistence. So they seem to persist. You can't get rid of them. So in the clinical context, this becomes very important. And so later on, if the persisters, they have the propensity. Now, in order to get them, you have to again now increase the dose of the antibiotic. And this is the recipe for developing resistance. So understanding persistence in the clinical context has become very important. And what has been shown by very fine experiments using microfluidics is that you can have capillaries through which you have single cells being subjected to antibiotic selection. So those guys who survive, the persisters, turn out to be those that end up growing very slowly. So they have metabolic processes which are slowed down, and it's as a result of the slowing down of the metabolic processes that has resulted in being resistant to the antibiotic. So this phenomena is independent of the particular antibiotic that you use. Whereas in the case of the resistance phenomena, the resistance is applicable only to that particular antibiotic that you're subjecting them to, other than in some rare cases, what about multi-drug resistance chain. So if you select for one antibiotic resistance, it also shows up having other resistance to other antibiotics. So the persistence phenomena has now been shown to be the result of stochastic fluctuations in the components in the cell, metabolic components in the cell, which results in their slow growth. And the typical kind of property of such systems is that when you remove the selection regimen, they grow back to normal. And then if you again subject them to the regimen, same proportion of cells that were there in the original culture now continue to exhibit the same phenotypic property. So now, this is a sort of very controversial paper that was published by the molecular biologist John Keynes in 1988. So in this paper, Keynes, Overmore, and Miller, the three authors, they challenged the commonly held belief that natural selection is the force that drives evolution. So the idea of natural selection was confirmed in 1943 by Luria and Delpru, who did the classic experiment using Escherichia coli, and this is the bacteriophage T1. And what they showed is that mutations pre-exist in the population. So if you have cultures that are shown, multiple cultures, like continuous cultures, and then expose them to the virus, they could show that the number of resistant cells fluctuate. And based on the statistical sort of explanation, they deduced that the fluctuation in the number of resistant cells is indicative of the fact that these mutations pre-exist. And this was the dogma that was there prevalent. And what Keynes and others did, and his colleagues did, was to challenge this dogma. And the reason why they challenged was that their argument was actually perfectly valid. The Luria-Delbruck experiment used a very lethal selection. So the bug is not given a fighting chance. So if it has to mount resistant counter attack against the virus, it needs a certain amount of time. And the time given was only 15 minutes for the phage to absorb to the bacteria. This, according to Keynes, was not sufficient to mount a response, so that by prediction, media and television introduced a bias, built-in bias in the experimental setup, so they will only see mutations and fail. When mutations can happen after exposure to the agent is not going to be seen. So they modified this experiment. The way they did was they used a cell or a bacterium, a strain that was resistant, that was muted at the lactose loop. So it is functionally lactose negative. And what they did was
natural selection, what's happening. So the mutations pre-exist in the population.
Yes.
Am I confusing if I understood it? It's suppressive mutation. It's accumulating suppressive mutation, or means a second site mutation somewhere else?
It doesn't matter. All that matters is that you become lactose positive. Acquire the ability to break down lactose. It can be the reversion of the original mutation or mutations in the suppressor at another second site. The net result is that you are getting capability of functioning. Okay. So, and this created a substantial amount of furor. This was published in Nature. And on the same issue, Frank Stahl, another very senior molecular biologist, wrote the New Review section for this particular issue. He titled that piece as "There is a unicorn in the garden." So the idea was that saying or questioning Luria Delbruck's conclusion, questioning natural selection, is almost saying that there is a unicorn in my garden. So nobody will believe it. And for several months after this paper was published, enormous amount of correspondence in the Nature letter, people arguing for and against the observation that Keynes had reported. Okay. So, and in fact, he made very provocative statements in that paper. So in fact, he even proposed that information can flow back from protein back to the DNA. And how does this happen? So he had postulated that, see, the transcription process is error prone. It's not a high fidelity operation like DNA replication. So when the lac said gene is transcribed, the RNA polymerase introduced many mutations. And in the case of bacteria, there is co-translation and transcription. So transcription process, the ribosomes attach to the RNA as it's being made in the nascent form. And as a result, they can also have beta galactosidase made in the process of translation. So Keynes' argument was, if you have a functional enzyme, that will enable the cell to grow on the spot because there is lactose present in the medium. And if by a process of finding out which cell is growing, then if there is some kind of a machinery which can reverse transcribe that messenger RNA that gave you a functional enzyme, that reverse transcription will give you a gene that is now wild type. And if this gene can recombine in the locus, the chromosomal locus, you can now revert back to wild type phenotype, back plus phenotype. So essentially, from phenotype to genotype information flow. So, and he called this phenomena as directed mutation, so that evolution can now proceed in a directed fashion. So that's why he created such a furor, even though it was a microbiology experiment. Since Luria Delbruck experiment was used as a paradigm to show that natural selection is occurring, so any question of the Luria Delbruck experiment will bring down the whole edifice of... Yes?
Just a point of clarification. You say Luria Delbruck showed that selection was working, but I think really their central claim and their finding is that mutations occur rapidly with respect to environment. And this is what Keynes challenged.
Yes.
Successfully.
In the sense, he challenged successfully in the sense that the design was flawed, because their selection regimen did not give the bacterium a fighting chance. Okay, I used to, when I teach, I tell this joke. It's like having a gun to your head, mutate now or die, and then put the trigger. That's the amount of time that it gave for the organism.
So, this paper subsequently showed to be...
Yes. No, but the observation is correct.
Yes.
The interpretation was wrong. So, the first evidence the reverse transcription idea was fantastic. In fact, Frank Stahl, who wrote the News and Views, did not take any side. So he just wanted to make sure that people read this paper and then pointed out the kind of complexity that it generated. But what it did was, it stimulated enormous amount of research by various people to understand what happens to bacteria when they are starved. So far, bulk of the experiments in the bacterial systems were done, performed using bacteria that are grown in expensive medium import from HIPCO, nice shakers, so that they are given all the kind of comforts and then you are making conclusions about what happens to mutation rates and all. So this was the first time focus attention on the fact that much of what bacteria do in the real world is under extreme cases of starvation. So the phenomena of what we now call stationary phase physiology became very important, and there were several subsequent pieces of work, very elegant pieces of work, that actually show that it is still Darwinian. There is, the jury is still out on the directed mutation idea. So what turned out is that bacteria can now, see, the question that many people, that bothered many people, is that, see, mutations are always associated with errors during replication. So if a bacterium has stopped growing, its DNA is not being replicated. So how can bacteria in stationary phase mutate? So how can evolution function when everything is shut down? Okay, this was a question. And it was very elegantly shown is that the bacterial system, they have repair processes. So during stationary phase, there's a lot of insult to the genome, lots of mutations happening, but there is also error repair processes going on. And the polymerases involved in the case of repair during stationary phase, they are different from the polymerases that are called into function when they are replicating actively in the exponential phase. And these polymerases, POL4 and POL5, were later on shown to be error prone. So they make more mistakes. Their fidelity is not as good as DNA polymerase 3. Okay. And it was believed that this process has evolved in such a way that the polymerases caught into function are more mutagenic because the bacterium is going through a tough time. So evolution clearly needs genetic change, and therefore error-prone polymerases will give you a higher mutation frequency because there is no recombination here. Whereas in eukaryotes, most of the diversity is generated by recombinational processes.
Can we get to questions later? So
the very first idea of reverse transcription was shown to be wrong by the fact exactly what I mentioned a while ago, that many of the mutations that give you lac plus phenotype are suppressor mutations. So the original mutation is still present, but it is being suppressed by mutation in some other loci, so that the idea that the transcription process has given you a wild type messenger RNA, that was proved to be wrong. Okay. So, I would like to conclude by going through another very interesting concept that emerged soon after Cain's experiment. So this experiment was done by Roberto Porter and his colleagues at the Harvard Medical School. So what they did was they took a bacterial culture, and all students of microbiology know that if you do a growth curve, you have a pattern like this. So starting from small titer, you give a very low titer to inoculate the culture and follow over a period of days. So there's a lag phase and the exponential phase, and then when materials run down, these are called Dutch culture. You are not introducing any more nutrients into the culture. So whatever is there at the beginning, that's what they had to handle. So the stationary phase is there, and then there's what's called the death phase. Okay. So, and most microbiology students have thought that you extrapolate that and it will be zero. So the entire population will vanish. But it doesn't happen. You do a real growth curve experiment. Students, all you need is a central flask and an incubator and a sterile pool where you can inoculate, you find that it drops, 99% of the cells die, and 1% cell survive. But if you start with 100 million cells, one person is still a million cells, substantially larger. And what's interesting is that it tapers off in this fashion. So it's stable. And the number remains stable over a very long period of time. And this was puzzling because what is happening? Why are the cells not dying? The textbooks say that they have to die and crash and become zero, but that doesn't happen. And the explanation given was that this is a dynamic phase, and this is dynamic because active natural selection processes are going on in this phase, and what happens is they can accumulate mutation so that their siblings are dying and they're releasing large amounts of proteins, carbohydrates, DNA, you name it. So if the cells cell acquires a mutation that can make use of any of these components, then they can grow. But this growth is short-lived because whatever nutrient that's available is also transient. But then, in the process of growing, they can have another mutation. So now, the second mutation will help you survive by growing on some other substrate. And in some cases, early part, they can be additive. So the mutation 1 and 2 gives you an additive advantage. But over a period of time, such takeovers happen. And he coined a very interesting terminology. He called them GASP. Cells are literally gasping. But the GASP is an acronym for growth advantage in stationary phase. So this is natural selection happening in the test tube. And this was published in Science in 1993. So we have, we actually collaborated with Roberto on some of these experiments. And so we have tried to, in the lab, look for loci where mutations can now give you growth advantage in stationary phase. So many loci have been identified. One of the loci is the system that we work with, what's called the BGL gene. So if you have a mutation that turns on the BGL operon, you can show that if you do a competition experiment in the laboratory between a wild type and a mutant, even though the mutant is four orders of magnitude lower in initial titer, it can catch up with the wild type cell. And one of the mutations, interestingly, happens to be the HNS locus that I was talking to you about. So if you have a mutation in HNS, that gives you growth advantage. But it has to be a special class of mutation. It cannot be a null mutation. This is also into this issue has come up again and again in biology, because many times null mutations don't give you any phenotype or a completely negative phenotype. So what you need to do is an allele that is a hypermon. So that's exactly what is happening in this case. This is an HNS mutation that is partially functional. And what the lab, one of my students has shown, Savita's work shows that the fitness advantage of the mutation is different at different stages of stationary phase. In the early stationary phase, the same mutation crashes when you compete against the parent, whereas at later stages of the stationary phase, it gives you a growth advantage, showing that the environmental conditions change very dramatically, so that what is good in one environment, definitely the same allele does not have the same kind of fitness as the one environment versus another environment. I think I'll stop here. Use the remaining part of the talk to see if there are any questions or clarifications.
Yeah, there's a question here.
How does the suppression of mutation due to a mutation in a different loci disprove the theory of reverse transcription?
Because by the reverse transcription idea, that gene mutation has to be, that messenger RNA has to be, you have to make a completely wild type messenger RNA. Here this is not happening. This is because it is still making the defective messenger RNA. But that defect is glossed over by having the suppression.
Reverse transcription can happen.
It can happen, but there is no evidence so far in the bacterial system for the presence of reverse transcription.
Well, I think the confusion is that the seed, the DNA which is made from the corrected mRNA has to be integrated in the original locus.
Yes. Then only that recombination step has to take place. Then only it will be heritable. Otherwise it will be only transient. So that's very crucial.
Suppose there is no mutation at a different locus, which is such as this
process. Then it becomes inheritable.
So there is a possibility that it can happen. Because transcription can lead to inheritable changes.
Yes, but this so far it has not been confirmed. So the particular demonstration that it is suppressor mutation has to, you have to involve other mechanisms other than the
mutation. Yeah, any other questions?
I think we have.
Actually, many of the heterolog proteins, especially in microbes, are regulated by having a RNA thermoregulator in the leader sequence, wherein at a lower temperature, you have a hairpin loop which inhibits the downstream translation process, and as soon as the temperature goes up, it melts down the hairpin loop and the translation. So, I mean, I was wondering if any such mechanism also occurs in heat shock proteins in Drosophila.
No, the mechanisms are different. So, even though there is clear conservation of the genes, the regulatory mechanisms are quite dramatically different in the mechanisms. But prokaryotic gene expression varies from eukaryotic gene quite substantially. But the genes are conserved.
Yeah, I was just wondering that it seems that
in the growth phase, you would think that enzymes and genes responsible for food utilization or metabolite utilization should be preferentially somehow mutated compared to, for example, housekeeping genes. So do you find, for example, that DNA breaks are more likely to happen in utilization genes compared to housekeeping genes and therefore lead to higher mutation rates in those
genes? Yeah, it's exactly the opposite. So when the culture hits stationary phase, the message is survival. Hang on there, don't do anything. Okay, no, all metabolic activities are down the unit. We don't want to grow because the genome has accumulated mutations. So what the cell tries to do is hang in there, hoping that the environment will change and it will go back. So, and this is brought about, I didn't have the going into detail. There's a specific sigma factor called RPOS. I think this touched upon in one of the earlier talks. And as a result of overexpression of or availability of higher levels of RPOS during stationary phase, there is competition. So most of the metabolic pathways are controlled by sigma 70, which is a housekeeping sigma. So once you have more polymerases with a sigma S in it, those genes will be spared from being done. Okay, so what this inter- I didn't go into the details. One of the mutations that gives you the growth advantage phenotype is a mutation in RPOS itself. The reason for it cannot be a null. If you have a null mutation, the cell will not survive stationary. So it's a hypomorph, so that you are bringing down the activity of RPOS, so that some sigma 70 can go and transcribe genes that are in there.
First of all, I wish to congratulate you for this extraordinary summary of more than 100 years of genetics. First, a technical issue. In the late 30s, there was a paper published using Sebastian Martensis, whereby in this post-long phase, was a way in which similar to the ones that you showed, where there was cannibalism.
Yeah.
In other words, cells eat the rest of the cells that die.
Right.
So that is another way of explaining that phase that is stationary after the log.
Yeah, once you reach the
right.
Static part.
That is just a comment about the technical details that
yes,
you went
through. Here also one can call these as cannibalism.
Sorry?
This is also sort of cannibalism.
Yes.
Because they are surviving on their siblings.
Right.
Okay, so there is a lot of scope for doing sociobiology type of experiments. Who dies and who survives.
Right. Which
Okay, there are other things that I didn't go into details. The RPOS mutation is one of the GAS mutations. In Bacillus subtilis, a similar thing happens. So subtilis response to starvation is different. It's four-related. Whereas here, the idea is to lie dormant, become resistant to osmotic stress and all the stresses, but survive somehow. And the cell survives. Whereas in the case of subtilis, it gets converted into a spore. And the sporulation process is extremely energy intense because enormous number of genes have to be expressed for the transition from the vegetative to the sporulation stage. So there, it's rather interesting, it is delayed as much as possible. So the commitment to sporulate, they hold this thing in time. So that what happens is the others who are not committed to sporulation, let them die. So that at their expense, these guys can grow for some more time. So the cells are essentially waiting for better opportunity. So correlation is turned on ultimately when the siblings are also dead. And this is again the decision to correlate or not to correlate is taken at a stochastic test.
Now, thank you very much for that clarification. Now, moving to the meaning of this in the concept of what has happened during this century, I was wondering whether you could comment on the fact that in a way you have been saying that the central dogma of molecular biology has collapsed. That is one of the issues.
Why would you say that? I don't know whether... See, there's a lot of misconceptions about the central dogma. So the central dogma simply talks to you about the direction of information transfer.
Right, and you
the went... The final details are not as important. It never be. If you go back... See, Watson did some tinkering with things. So what we know today as central dogma is what Watson had popularized. But if you go back to the 61 paper where Rick makes his proposal, he doesn't really care between RNA and DNA as information carriers. So the central dogma, as far as I can understand, is simply that information can flow from nucleic acid to protein and not the other direction.
But you gave evidence, or at least suggested, that
but
it could go in the...
That was thrown out. Ains suggested this idea, so, but we are still in the natural selection mode, Darwinian mode, as far as explanation for that phenomenon is concerned.
And the other... thank you for this verification. And the other question I have is, how come that it took so long for people to recognize the value of Waddington's idea?
I would say that
I can equate Waddington to Mendel to some extent. Yes, exactly. So, 65 was when he read the paper to the Brunner Society, and 66 it was published. He tried to write to various people. There are on documents correspondence between him and the German botanist called Nagli.
Yes.
And Nagli didn't have any clue as to what Mendel was talking about.
I think that even
No, there's a lot of controversy. So, but I think now it has been established that Darwin was not exposed to Mendel's paper. In fact, J Biosciences has a series of interesting. There's actually a very nice article by Michel Morange about central dogma, because recently celebrated golden jubilee of central dogma. So the revised version of that same article by Morange is also published in Resonance. Michel Morange, central dogma, if you give us email, Google query, you can get that article. Nicely written article.
I think it's one reason why Waddington wasn't taken up as quickly as he should have been was that he was perceived as being he was perceived as being Lamarckian. I mean, he wasn't, but that's how people thought of him. And it was at that time it was regarded as a heresy. So I think that he didn't take off as quickly as he should have done because of that.
Because the epigenetic concept is resembled to Lamarckian.
Yes, I can extreme Lamarckian. I mean, Waddington said no, but I mean, but he was actually perceived that way.
No, it was just a comment about the central dogma that they asked Crick why he used the term dogma, and he said that he didn't know the meaning of the word. It does seem serious. So he used
that itself is unfortunate, but the dogma itself is misunderstood by including students of molecular biology.
Aisha?
Could you say something about how the decisions I made to phosphorylate shut down?
Phosphorylation.
How is that controlled? What's the mechanism?
Usually, phosphorylation is the result of some kind of a signal transduction process.
No, did you say, I'm sorry, just to get the question clear, did you say phosphorylation of genes?
Yes, I have the
gene order.
I guess so, I mean, you find out.
You are talking about phosphorylation of gene product.
Methylation.
This is not an area that I am comfortable with. I am a through and through bacterial person. So I didn't want to venture into an area that I am not very comfortable with. Anybody in the audience?
Well, very generally, so that the discussion can carry on, there are enzymes which recognize certain sequences in DNA. These CTG islands that were mentioned, I think in backstop, are quite common. They can recognize them as substrates and add a methyl group from a methyl donor, a well-known intermediate. basically known as a methyl donor. So it's a standard chemical reaction. Substrate, the presence of enzyme, and whatever the methyl donor is, gets methylated. And there's a second enzyme which can demethylate this. So at a certain concentration of these enzymes and the substrate, there's a steady state level of methylation.
So the decision is for the expression of that enzyme to demethylate, so that
yeah, as I said, at a steady state, there is a steady state level of methylation of a particular sequence. Now, if one of these enzymes is turned off, you get an entire demethylation or, in fact, constitutive methylation.
Yeah, that is the process.
Yeah. There was a question there, Tariq, yeah.
So, just a comment, why, in response to what Carlos was asking, why would Intel recognize? I think it's similar what Mendel also went through, because Mendel's, you know, discoveries were also like 1905, he was rediscovered. And Waddington's idea, I believe, was such a genius, because he was talking more like what in today's terms we call systems biology, you know,
yes,
gene networks and these things. And in 70s and 80s and 90s, we were looking more or less one gene, one protein, mutant, and like recreating the genome. Now, once we have the tools, we realize that his idea was perfectly valid.
In fact, on the issue of resonance, from which I've taken Vidya's article, there are other articles that highlight some of those aspects. Available free on the Indian Academy of Science website. Bonner has also written a nice talk. Yes.
I think Sylvia, yeah, one second.
So I'm going to ask a very stupid question. For me, it is not really clear how do you decide what is a phenotype. For instance, let's imagine that you have a cell that is red in a certain condition and blue in another condition. Would you say that it has two different phenotypes, or would you say that it has a phenotype that is red in one condition and blue in another condition?
Yeah.
For instance, if these conditions are just, I mean, in the growth of a colony, you could go through different conditions and then it may switch from red to blue just in the course of the life of the population.
Absolutely. First of all, let me do this. There's nothing called a stupid person. So, and what you said is absolutely right. So phenotype has to be defined, the environment under which you're observing has to be defined. For example, in the simple experiment that I talked about, you have a lactose negative cell. And if you take that cell and plate it on a medium which contains only lactose as the carbon source, it will not grow. So you call the phenotype lactose negative. So now, if a mutant appears and grows on that plate, you call that as a lactose positive. So, and everything here revolves around the fact that you have a medium, and that is a differentiating factor so that you can tell apart which is lactose negative and which is lactose positive.
The concept of phenotype is much more relative than the concept of genotype. Am I wrong? I have the feeling that the genotype, I mean, a gene is a bit more specified with respect to a phenotype.
Right. Phenotype, one has to specify the environment. Considering the fact that there are changes in the phenotype based on the environment, it is a relative.
There's a question here at the back. Yes,
below. Sir, just I'm confused about this. To say that the electoral culture, so because I'm audible to you, bro.
Yes.
So, when you said that in the stationary phase, so 1% of the bacteria survive, and during this intra-specific competition, actually, they ultimately change the behavior because of the cannibalism, or you say, or maybe they start feeding on the dead cells.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know whether there is a change in the behavior.
Well, how long does the particular stationary phase will continue if you don't supply?
Indefinitely.
Okay.
So you can grow the bacteria, all you need to do is to keep them shaking, and over a period of time, if the water evaporates, you have to supply distilled water. So that's very crucial. The volume has to be maintained.
Okay. The next question is, why does 1% survive actually? Is this because of natural selection?
Yes.
Or you say that the mutation actually prefixed for certain other cases?
No, this is a case of natural selection. That's what I'd like to emphasize. Because if one mutation occurs naturally,
randomly, so that it gives the ability for the culture to grow, and in the process of growing, it can accumulate other mutations. And if any of those mutations give the capability of using any of the breakdown products, that will go okay, and the process continues.
Yes, because of those mutations, probably they have to change their behavior as well.
Yeah, but I don't know whether it's called it behavior. It is a growth property change. The ability to utilize particular substrates, they change.
If I say it's feeding behavior change, is it okay?
Behaviorist, I don't have any problem, but those who are...
Okay, last question from Idris. We'll carry on. Okay.
Sir, you told about that you grow those bacteria on lactose medium.
Yes.
I'd like to know how many of, what was the percentage which survived?
Percentage, see, what happened was, if you examine the plates over a period of time, more and more colonies kept on appearing. So on the first day, you have 10 colonies, you keep the plate in the incubator, next day you get 20 colonies, 30, 40, 50, the numbers kept on.
So is there a possibility that in those bacteria there have been that change in the of reading frame?
Sorry, I didn't get the
could
last
there,
part.
Could there have been a change in the reading frame in some of those
mutations? As I said, many of them have been sequenced, and many of them carry suppressor mutations. Mutations are other loci, which will now suppress the effect of the first mutation.
Okay.
Is it antibiotic resistance in bacteria follow this phenotype to genotype phenomena?
There are two issues here. One, development of resistance. So in the case of antibiotic resistant mutants, clearly that's a genotype, and that gives you the resistance genotype. But it can't be applied in the case of the persisters because there is no genetic change. The resistance is due to a stochastic process whereby their growth is slowed down, so that the antibiotics not able to get them, because in many of the cases, the antibiotics kill cells that are actively dividing and growing. So they lie low, and let the thing pass by, and then once the antibiotic is dropped, they begin to grow.
Is injection in growth itself is genetically controlled?
No,
makes
it's a stochastic process.
Induce growth rather than dying.
No, it's a stochastic process. But more recently, people have done experiments whereby they have identified genes. If you mutate them, the percentage of persisters increased by two orders of magnitude. So, and this has to do with sort of system, toxin, antitoxin systems that are present in bacteria. So maybe we can discuss that later.
So I think that brings up a nice point what you made just now, and it came up after Monish's talk yesterday, I think, which is, persistence is an epigenetic phenomenon.
Yeah.
It doesn't require genetic change, but the capacity to persist can be under genetic regulation. So I think on that very happy note, we end this morning's program and meet at 1:30, please. So